This is Mike Pinnock, recorded by Chris Eldon Lee on the 19th of November 2011. Mike Pinnock, Part 1.
Mike Pinnock, born in Milton Mowbray, Leicestershire in 1954.
And your birthday is?
6th of March.
So now you are 50.
I'm 57, yeah.
Yeah. What kind of education did you have? Did you have further education?
I did, although not to the level I would like to have done. I did an ordinary national certificate in electrical and electronic engineering, then I did a higher national diploma, HND, and then I went into BASS. Oh, sorry, I was in industry and then went into BASS.
What was it about industry that made you want to leave?
This was... I'm talking about, I did an apprenticeship with GEC, General Electric Company, and that got me around a lot of British industry at the time. So this was 1970 through to 76. And with the benefit of hindsight, I can see that British industry was at an all-time low. I mean, that's well recognised now. And industry was quite a depressing place to work at the time. And I was working as a commissioning engineer and then as a junior manager, what they called an area engineer, running teams. And I found it very stifling. There were always people looking aghast at, quite frankly, how much work you were putting in. I quite often, particularly as you were working away from home, I quite often preferred just to get the job done as quickly as possible, whereas other people were clock watching. And then the whole atmosphere around places like the Cowley Motorworks at Oxford, used to work in a lot of the car industry at the time, was just outright confrontational. I'd also decided, I don't want to make a big thing of this, it wasn't some big moral thing, but I decided I didn't want to work in the defence industry, which is a huge part of the electronics industry at the time. So a combination of things came to a head when GEC... I felt it weren't offering me many more opportunities, so I started looking for something else. And I realised, against the background of what I just said, I really wanted something quite different.
What actually had led you into engineering and industry in the first place?
Probably a lack of knowledge of what I really wanted to do. The only thing I knew about from because my father was an electronics engineer, was engineering. I did hugely enjoyed science at school and was always building things. So, I could see that I had some talent, some skills there. But I can't say it was a great burning zeal. It was just, that's the thing I know, so I'll go into that sort of thing.
What would you say was your first awareness that a place called the Antarctic actually existed?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. Almost certainly the film, Scott of the Antarctic. I wouldn't want to say that made a huge impression on me. I was much, much more aware of mountaineering, the Himalayas, Everest. I did a lot of hill walking. I'd started rock climbing. And I think that sort of then led you into, through people like reading Tillman's literature and that, sort of started to lead you towards the polar regions. And ice and snow I did always find fascinating. Still am very keen on winter walking, much, much more than summer walking, quite frankly. So when finally BASS did impinge on my consciousness, it was hugely attractive. Yeah, it was just, wow, yes, there's an opportunity.
This was an advert you saw?
I saw an advert. Actually, I didn't see it. my really good friend of mine, best man at my wedding, we were out at the pub one night and I was probably crying into my beer saying how miserable it was working for GC or whatever. And he said, I saw just the advert the other day, it's just the thing for you. And he then passed me the clipping a couple of days later. And it was BASS advertising for what they called ionospheric physicists, but they wanted either engineers or physicists to go and run the ionospherics program down in the Antarctic at their bases. And for some reason that I still don't understand, I did sit on it for a couple of weeks and then... wrote off, got the application form and applied. And then found myself in Cambridge in the new building then. This was the summer of 1976. And BASS had just been brought together from all its different university locations and the headquarters in London had all been brought together in Cambridge. So I sort of went into this brand new building. And with the benefit of hindsight from where I am now, that really was the start of modern bass, you know, all being brought together. That enabled a lot of things that hadn't been possible really previously, particularly on the science side.
What do you recall about the interview? Who was on the other side of the table?
Yes, Eric Salmon was the chair. John Dudney and Dick Cressman were the other two interviewers. I remember immediately warming to Eric Salmon, who I love greatly. He was a lovely man. Did things his own way, but was very much on the FID side. I remember him giving me the toughest question, which was something along the lines of, so what do you plan on doing when you return from the Antarctic? And I didn't have a clue. So I gave some really waffly answer like, oh, well, I would aim to capitalise on the experiences I'd had. And I heard him mutter under his breath to John Dudney, what is a stevedore? Which, of course, having, you know, after having done a relief at Halley, you entirely understood that remark. yes, that's the main thing I remember from the interview.
How much at that point did you know or not know about ionospherics?
Absolutely nothing. I mean, I did read up before the interview. I went to an encyclopedia and found out what the ionosphere was. But it really, shortwave radio and its means of propagation I knew about, but I didn't know anything about the physics. Fortunately for me and for the rest of my career, really, because BASS couldn't afford to have the data that was collected by the radars analysed, they trained engineers like me to analyse the data. And that just naturally led you into the physics. Well, I found that was the case anyway. So they gave you this training from people who knew, you know, it wasn't just a technical exercise. They would explain as they went along what you were actually seeing in the physics and the way the ionosphere was behaving. And I found it fascinating. And there was the ionosphere over Halley is a very curious beast. It's very significantly different from anywhere else. Significantly different from anywhere at low or mid latitudes. When you get to that sort of high polar latitude, the ionosphere is really very challenging to interpret what you're seeing.
Can you elaborate on that?
Basically, it's a photographic... Well, it was in those days. It's all digital now, of course. It was a photographic film record, so you just ran a piece of film past a cathode ray tube. Then you developed the film yourself. We had all the developing kit in the hut. And you ended up with this big spool of 35mm film. And then you looked... The machine went off every 15 minutes and you put it on a viewer and you just wound through. And certain characteristic traces you'd see on the film. And if they were nice and well behaved, you could then take off what the electron density was in the ionosphere. And you'd see the diurnal variation, seasonal variation. However, the closer you get to the auroral zone, and then when you're in the auroral zone, those records become incredibly complex and are really quite challenging, even to this day, to interpret exactly what it is you're seeing. We saw one feature regularly every night, which we now know is basically a big hole in the ionosphere, something called the mid-latitude trough. It's now quite well understood, but Halley contributed a significant amount of data towards that understanding, and then the satellite era sort of started to map that out. So it was actually, again, that was another feature of when I started work. Within a few years, we were working a lot with NASA satellite missions, so combining the ground records with the satellites that were flying over Halley at 350 kilometres altitude or whatever. So, again, it was a huge growth area then as well in the science.
Were the conditions in the Antarctic purely natural, or was man also, as he has with the ozone layer, being influential in the peculiarities of the Antarctic?
Probably not then. I mean, bear in mind, when I first went down, we didn't know what we were doing to the ozone hole. That was another 10 years away, really, before we had that understanding. No, it seemed completely virgin, completely untouched by man. It always struck me that, you know, you only... literally had to walk, you know, 5-10 minutes from base, and, you know, with your back to the base at least, you know, you were seeing something that was just completely untouched by man.
But I was thinking that the strange conditions in the ionosphere that you were...
Oh, sorry, yes. Yeah, no, those...
Was that man-influenced?
No, that's completely natural. We understand that fairly well now, that at the auroral zones and polewoods, that's where all the interaction between the material that's coming off from the sun, the solar wind, interacts with the Earth's magnetic field and shapes what you're seeing there. But because the sun is highly variable in its output, you end up with a very variable ionosphere.
How did a humble GEC engineer take to this kind of... cosmic stuff?
It was fantastic. It was completely liberating, actually. I was fortunate, and I must have had I had nearly a 4-month training period in Cambridge, and towards the end of that period I'd mastered most of the training, and then I got interested in one or two bits of engineering. And again, this is where it was so liberating compared to GEC. It was, well, yeah, that's not a bad idea. Why don't you go ahead and see what you can do? And people would, you know, and I'd sort of say, well, I haven't got this bit of equipment. They say, well, we might be able to get this from here. So it was just the, you know, it was the classic FID-BAS attitude of, you know, let's see what we can do, can do. So it was that and the intellectual challenge, and then the actual... the challenge of meeting all these people from very different backgrounds, very different science areas. It was quite... That summer in Cambridge I found quite heady. You know, it really was... it was exciting. It was exciting.
How was the Antarctic when you got there?
I guess... I hope BAS still does quite a good job at preparing people. You know, we run things like the Girton Induction Workshop, which, in my day was called the Cambridge Conference. So the whole point of that is that when you get there, you go, ah, yes, you know, I've seen the pictures of that, or these days I've seen the video, I've been told about that. So there was an element, it's difficult to convey it, there was, I think as the ship sailed into the Weddell Sea, there was just straightforward awe, you know, incredible, you know, you've never seen anything like it. Traveling up to the base, it was still sort of wow, you know. I guess around the base it was okay, yeah, I've seen the pictures of this, I was expecting that, I know this is like that sort of thing. And also actually just the incredible realization that although you were in a potentially a very, very hostile environment, it actually, at times, was not only remarkably easy to be comfortable, but, you know, it could be a real pleasure working on a summer's day at Halley outside. It's I think you quickly get over the natural, you know, most humans would go, why do I want to go there? You know, it's minus whatever temperature and wind and it's all just ice. And you quickly began to feel at home in the place.
Was there any kind of glass wall between the practical chaps and the scientists who are doing their research?
Yeah, I mean, yes, most definitely. I wouldn't say it was a glass wall. I think there was, I think at best it was, there was a recognition on the science side that a lot of the support staff had a lot more experience of life, or a lot more practical, quite frankly, than many of us from the science side. The science side, like myself, were, you know, very typically 21, 22 years old. I'd probably had a lot more practical experience than most people working in the ionospheric side or the MET side, for example. Most of them would have been straight out of university. So I think there was that natural division between people who'd seen a good bit more of life than most of the scientists. At the same time, the support side, many of them were very, very keen to support the science, had a lot of respect for the science, were keen to help it happen, keen to understand more about it. So I think at best it worked very well. There are times when, some of the best scientists can be ridiculously demanding and not that aware of what's going on around them at times, and that can lead to tensions. But they usually get put right fairly quickly.
So here you are at the beginning of 1977.
Yeah.
At Halley. And what were the first things that you were being asked to do? Were you deep-ended?
Yes, I was very much deep-ended. In fact, I look back at it now, I was sent up to the drum line at Halley, where we were unloading the 45-gallon drums. And basically, I think somebody forgot that I was out there. So I spent the first 10 days non-stop just rolling drums on the drum line. Afterwards, someone sort of said, you shouldn't have been up there that long. We should have taken you off there and given you another job. But I just thought, well, this is what they asked me to do. So I got on with it. So I did spend 10 days just rolling drums off Bass cargo sledges, which was never the easiest of activities, as anybody who's done it will tell you. And so it wasn't until the end of the relief that I actually really started to sort of be able to walk around the base, take a look, see where it was I was going to be working for the next couple of years, go down to the ship for the final sort of farewell party. It was very much straight in at the deep end.
This was Halley 3, wasn't it, when you got there?
This was Halley 3, the Armco base, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was... That, of course, in itself was an experience, because I kept going back to Halley 3 for many years afterwards. And it was always interesting to observe people's first reaction to, you know, going down the shafts, going into the base. It is quite alien. It's amazing how quickly it seemed like home. I mean, although these days with the surface bases at Halley and windows, etc., people sort of look askance somewhat at the under the ice spaces. I think what they don't recognise is that, particularly in the depths of winter during storms, getting to the shaft, climbing into it, pulling the hatch shut, and then going down into the light and the warmth of base actually felt very comfortable. And certainly the living block, you know, sort of, was home. A lot of wood features in it, which we don't always have these days on the bases. It felt cosy, yeah. It wasn't uniformly. I mean, you were always going in and out of the connecting tunnels, which would be at nearly zero or colder in winter. There were cosy bases.
No sense of claustrophobia?
Not for myself. There definitely were people I wintered with who found it claustrophobic. I think the only thing I suffered, and this was sorted out eventually, was we had very poor ventilation in the base. There was next to no ventilation designed into the base in 77, and I quickly realised that I pretty well had to go outside every day in order to stop getting a mild headache. I don't want to make it into a big thing, but when one of the builders, I think, came in 81, he set to sort of dragging air through the base and getting it ventilated. So that was a slightly ironic thing about the under the ice bases, was that they got more and more comfortable as they got to the end of their life. You know, everything else was working against them. They were being crushed. Eventually, you were having to abandon them, but they generally were made more and more comfortable through their lifetime. And certainly, the good ventilation system that was put in, and I think in 80 or 81, made a lot of difference.
This hasn't occurred to me before, but I'm trying to imagine, I've not been to Halley, I'm trying to imagine what it must be like to live in a tube in the middle of a block of ice. And I guess it's feels similar to being on a plane, in that you have no visible means of support. And I wonder how easy it is to get a good night's sleep when you know that actually below you is only ice and water, above you is only ice and air.
Not anything that ever troubled me. As I say, I found it a comforting place to come into from the outside, particularly in winter. The only disturbing thing was that, because I wintered 77, 78 and then 81, and by 1981 we knew that the base was close to the end of its life. It did close in end of 1983. The Armco tube was being crushed. It had got to the stage already where the Armco tube was bearing on the eaves of a wooden hut. And then the hut was on a series of metal trellis. The Armco bolts started shearing, And these are bolts that are, you know, a good sort of 20 millimetre, 25 millimetre diameter. So when one of those sheared, it was like a rifle shot going off. So the only discomfort I used to experience would be, you know, at 3 a.m, you'd wake up with your heart pounding because basically a rifle shot had gone off. So that was the only discomfort, I think, that I experienced. I say I did find it a comfortable base to be in.
Most of your work, though, initially was establishing the technology to do this ionospheric research, which I guess was near the Alden outdoors. So tell me about the outdoor duties you had early on.
Yeah, the main hut I worked in was a hut from Halley 2, which had been built on the surface and then gradually buried. All the equipment was set up when I came in. It had been running for a number of years. I did bring in a complete new suite of equipment in 1981, at the start of that year. When I first went there, it was all set up and running. It wasn't in particularly good condition, and it became clear to me after a month or two working there that the performance of the machine was not what it should be. It was below spec. So it was quite a long haul that winter of getting things up to scratch and working properly. In 1981, yes, was very much a case of, in the very fairly short relief period, I think we might have had 3 weeks that year. We brought in a whole new radar, the first computer-controlled radar. We had 45-metre masts to stick up, 245 metres and 130-metre mast. Huge amount of cable work to run around, whole new receiver array to put in. We had a whole new generator set up as well, just to power that experiment. It was a great project to be part of, but yeah, it was a very demanding period.
Just so I know, was this the Super Darn you're talking about?
No, that came later. This was called, Bass called it the Advanced Ionospheric Sounder. It was an instrument that had been designed by a lab in the States, and John Dudeney had negotiated an incredible deal whereby we got a huge amount of the equipment for very, very little cost. So we just had to provide all the basic infrastructure for the antenna array. So that was the Advanced Ionospheric Sounder. It was the first digital controlled instrument on base. And it also, at the end of 1982, and because of the Falklands War, it was also provided the computer that hosted the first satellite communications with Halley, because basically you needed two computers at either end that would speak to each other. So that was a very exciting project to be involved with, and it really was. Although I loved the Antarctic, and I couldn't, you know, after I came out with 77, 78, I couldn't imagine it not being part of my life. But I recognised it was probably unlikely I might go back. And then this new project came up, and Bass were going to train me in computers, which I'd not really had in my academic training. So it was a great career opportunity as well.
How reliable were those early digital things? I mean, the compact disc was 18.
Oh yeah, no, we didn't have compact discs.
So, well, the point I'm making is it's even before compact
discs.
It was fairly basic digital technology. So tell me about how much faith you had in it all.
The actual computer unit itself worked very well, and you could really get into the guts of the thing. It gave you a fantastic grounding on how computers actually worked. All the peripheral devices were incredibly unreliable. We had a mighty 10 megabytes of hard disk. In contrast today with, you know, anybody's laptop's got 500 gigabytes on there. Those hard disks used basically the same technology as today, with magnetic recording heads flying above a disk surface, but you set the whole thing up. You had to align the heads, you had to configure the linear motors for loading the heads, and you only had to have the slightest bit of dust get in there because it was an open system, and the heads would crash into the disk surface. So you did a lot of activity that, you just don't do these days. These days, you just, if you do have a disc crash, as you know, you just pull another one off a shelf, plug it in, and away you go. So you'd spend hours on the bench setting up those units. I did have one memory fault, and again, this is a memory card that, you know, was a good sort of 40-centimeter square thing, probably had 28 kilobytes on it. And again, you could fault find down to the chip you know, that had failed. This is magnetic ferrite core memory as well. It wasn't chips. So it was fascinating technology to get into, and you could delve into it to a level that you just never do these days.
The fact that you were breaking this new ground technologically in the most remote part of the world, was the remoteness of the Antarctic actually a handicap? Were chaps back in elsewhere in the country, elsewhere in the world, finding the work easier than you were doing?
Yes, because most of the time you would just send the unit back to the manufacturer. You wouldn't, in the UK, you wouldn't dream of doing the sort of disc alignment procedures that we did on the spinning discs. You just pack it off to the manufacturer. They'd have someone on workbench. You'd turn it around in half an hour rather than, you know, the 4 hours it would take me. I felt an enormous amount of responsibility because this was a colossal project for Bass. It was a bold step.
We're talking about now about eight.
Well, about this. No, it's in 81, yeah, 1981. 81. Yeah. So certainly, and we had a lot of, as always, it wasn't so much the radar that let us down. We had enormous problems with the generator caboose. We were in basically converted freight containers that had the equipment in, another one had the workshop, and then a third one had a two generator, a diesel electric set for generating mains electricity. And that in itself was the first containerized generator unit that Bass had had. Not rocket science, but, I'll spare all the details, but we had a lot of units fail in that. We had a whole string of transformers fail in it, and until we eventually carefully unwound one and found that it had been badly assembled in the first place. So I actually spent almost, it seemed like I spent almost as much time helping the generator mechanic who'd come in with that unit, helping him in the generator shed as much time as I spent in the radar keeping that going.
Was this a project which NASA became involved in, or was that the later one?
Yeah, no, NASA were involved in this one. In fact,
lots of opportunity for egg on face then?
Yes, I mean, NASA were saying, right, you know, we were working with something called the Dynamics Explorer satellites. There were two satellites. So we'd get a list in over the telex saying, right, you know, there's going to be the satellite's going to be going over Halley or close to it on these times. We want you to run this program on the radar. And somewhere down the line, you know, over the next year, you'd know that NASA would be saying, right, come and tell us what you found, what you saw, to put in context what the satellite was seeing as it actually flew through the ionosphere. DE2, as it was actually flying at an altitude of about 350 kilometres, so it was right in the stuff that we're measuring from the ground.
Yeah. Did you ever come up with any results that took you by surprise?
Yes, indeed. I mentioned this nighttime feature, the high latitude, the mid-latitude trough that we saw every night. By 1976, people were beginning to understand how that formed. During certain very, very active conditions, we saw these troughs in the daytime, and that was a bit of a stunner. And we documented that very well, and then we went on in the early 80s to work with some modellers at Sheffield University and showed that basically it was very, very large electric fields in the ionosphere due to the activity from the sun that were driving the ionosphere so fast that they heated it up that certain chemical reactions then took place, which basically rapidly depleted the electron density in the ionosphere. And so even though it was daytime, where basically the radiation from the sun is regenerating the ionosphere all the time, this electric field was so strong that it could overcome the ionization that was being created by the sun and blow a hole in the ionosphere. It's since been learned that you can do similar things with rocket exhaust, for example, you know, when... anybody launches a rocket up there. Slightly different reaction. That's the amount of water vapour coming from the rocket motor.
So when these surprise daytime results started coming in, were you immediately convinced, or were you all being a bit sceptical about whether the machinery is still working properly?
I think by that stage we'd built up so much confidence in the machine. We knew it didn't lie. We knew we didn't have artifacts in there. So we were really quite confident about what we were seeing. It's a very good question, though. I mean, Halley will always be known for the discovery of the Antarctic ozone hole, and that's a whole other story, and I wasn't involved with that. But I was wintering on the base with people who were making the observations that led to that discovery. I know that when the team in Cambridge first found the ozone hole, they pored over the stuff for the best part of a year, pulling it apart, saying, well, what have we done wrong? Have we changed the calibration technique? Have we changed the method of observing? Because they were thinking, surely someone else must have seen this, you know. So, you do have doubts. Certainly with the project that I managed in the late 80s and well into the 90s, the Superdarn radar, yes, we did get, again, we got a result that suggested, again, very, very large electric fields, far larger than we really had been expecting to see, and also very confined, very narrow channels of rapid flow jets, basically, in the ionosphere. And, we did pore over the data on those for many months before we were convinced, you know, we could see these repeatedly and saying, yeah, this... we can believe the instrument.
This is now about 1988, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
I've got a little note here from Amanda saying, might be worth asking Mike to explain how the Superdarn radar works very simply.
Yeah, it's... But
it's not my field of expertise. You probably noticed that already.
Okay, yeah. Well, with the ionospheric studies up until 1988, we basically had a radar that most people would understand quite well. You send a pulse of radio energy vertically upwards and you reflect off the ionosphere overhead of Halley. And you can measure the electron density. So you get a profile, like a contour map, if you like, of the ionosphere, but just overhead Halley. It gives you a single point in the ionosphere. We wanted to get a much bigger view of the ionosphere. And of course, even the satellites flying overhead, they're just taking a slice through the ionosphere in basically one dimension. So we wanted this 2D view, and we got involved with Professor Ray Greenwald at the Applied Physics Laboratory, Johns Hopkins University in the States, and he realized that a series of technology developments had meant that you could now use something called an over-the-horizon radar. So instead of sending your signal out vertically, you were sending it out horizontally, and then you could steer the beam around in like with a classic radar dish. So you could now sit at Halley and send out your radio signals and scan about 3 million square kilometres of the ionosphere over East Antarctica. And you could look right beyond the South Pole Station up to, say, Vostok Station with this radar. And what you really measured was the electric fields in the ionosphere over that area. And we worked with Ray, who was really the inventor of this radar. I was fortunate to go to Labrador in Canada and help him install the first one of these there. And then we eventually managed to get the money to take the one into Halley. And that was probably one of the greatest things I feel I've done with BASS. It gave me the greatest sense of satisfaction. Was getting that radar into Halley. It was a huge undertaking, 16 antennae on sort of 10-meter towers, a lot of new technology again, and then finally switching that on and just seeing the screens light up with all the echoes coming from over South Pole when you were sat at Halley. And then the really exciting thing, this is getting into the science, but realizing that the direction of the magnetic field coming from the sun, so this is the sun's magnetic field, the direction of that magnetic field, say, rotating through 180 degrees and seeing the response in the ionosphere over South Pole happen within 2 minutes. So an immediate cause and effect. And by that stage, by the time we were running this radar, we could be getting the data in from NASA saying this is what the solar wind is doing. So you really had a sense of looking right out into space from Halley, which was stunning. It gave us brilliant results, and there's now 24 of those radars working around the world. It was such a powerful technique It gives you such a great view of the ionosphere and it's, you know, the Earth's magnetic field interacting with the sun.
Did Bash get the credit?
Yes, we did. Yep. Again, it's, well, I'd have to go into a lot of details of the science, but one of the most satisfying moments in my career was someone saying, you know, you put this picture up on the screen. This was at a conference in the USA. You put this picture up on the screen, Mike, and I just saw everybody around the room going, ah, he's got it. You know, that's what's happening. So, yeah, it's very, very satisfying. Yes, we did get the credit. I won't go into all the details of how we got the Superdawn radar, but there's no doubt at all that the Americans invested heavily in it. And the reason they did that was because we'd done the Advanced Ionospheric Sounder, which went in 1981, we'd done that so well, the Americans said, look, these guys can deliver, you know. And to be perfectly frank, we delivered a lot more cheaply than the Americans' contractors, because they use contractors to put it in, the likes of, well, ITT or now Raytheon, who charge contractors' rates, whereas we did it very much the Bass FID way. We assembled, you know, people like myself assembled all the antennae and put them up in the air. So we had this great reputation for trust these guys, they can deliver, they get it installed.
I can't help noticing that this great development took place after the Falklands War.
Yes, it did. And,
is that a coincidence?
No, it's probably not, because, of course, we got a lot, you know, Bass's budget basically doubled after the Falklands War. So, yes, we had more money. We also got the vastly improved communications. I don't think it would be difficult to install the sort of level of sophistication of equipment we were then getting without being able basically to pick up the phone and speak to a manager back in Cambridge and saying, I'm seeing this, and this, what does it mean? We don't do a lot of that even now. We don't, you know, we don't butt in, I'm talking, sorry, from the Cambridge manager's end, we don't butt in day by day, but there is the link there to help people out.
So this was science waiting to happen, was it? It could only really happen, A, when the budgets have been increased, and B, when you could actually, the communication systems were much better.
Yes, and I think also we needed some of the plant, vehicle plant, I mean. For example, for putting up the antennae in that, we needed cranes, cranes with sort of 14, 15-metre reach, for example. We'd not had those at Halley before, but then the building technology for the base demanded that. And that enabled us then to set the...
Is this where your steeplejacking skills that Eric Salmon mentioned in passing came in really handy?
Or No, he was talking about me being a stevedore rather than a steeplejack.
Yeah, sorry.
No, the steeplejack skills, that... well, we don't do it this way anymore because, of course, you know...
Not health and safety.
Health and safety, yes. Well, yeah, basically, when we took in the Advanced Ionospheric Sounder, we thought we have got to put up large vertical masts to get the most out of this machine. Now, a large vertical mast had been set up in the IGY base, and if you look in the annals of IGY... volumes, you'll see a very sad picture of a crumpled mast. And we now know that is because it's not that the mast can't stay up, it's that the stay wires, which are supporting it, are holding it in place. The tension on those gradually increases as the snow level increases, and you have to be constantly resetting the tension. Well, constantly. About once a month, going out, checking the tension on the stay wires, readjusting them, usually slackening off the tension because, say, the accumulating snow causes it to increase. So we worked out all these techniques, and then when it came to the steeplejack stuff, we basically applied, you know, standard climbing techniques for protecting ourselves. So it was all done safely. However, there was a point... I think in the early 90s when a Bass director went into Halley and saw these 45-metre masts there and suddenly realised for the first time that he had his people putting these up. And there was a lot of examination of that, and the upshot in the end is we now use professional mast directors. We have also people seconded from the RAF who again, are professional mast maintenance people. They come into Halley now each summer and do the maintenance and the erection of those masts.
But prior to that, had you actually found yourself sitting on the top of one of these things?
Yes. Yeah, I didn't find it a great challenge. I mean, even people on base sort of said, how can you do that, Mike? Because it's very different from rock climbing, because you have complete...
Well, there's no rock.
There's no rock, yes. You have complete exposure. You know, you can look through what you're hanging on to because it's a lattice mast. I always found when you actually got into the work... I should say I didn't do it all on my own. There was always someone up there with me. But once you got into the work and you concentrated on it, and you're concentrating very much because you've got to work safely for very obvious reasons. I used to very much enjoy the work. It used to be the ground crew who used to get cold first and fed up first and say, come on, it's time to come down, let's go and get some tea.
So these are your basic climbing skills from your teenage years coming into
Yes, yeah, indeed, yes.
Could the weather change between, there you are at the top of the 45-foot mast, could the weather change by the time you got to the bottom?
Yes. I mean, temperature inversions at Halley are very common. In fact, there's a whole area of physics we study called boundary layer physics, which produces temperature inversions. And anybody who's wintered at Halley, or whether they realise it or not, will have observed those temperature inversions. You see miraging of icebergs out in the Weddell Sea. You also see some interesting wave phenomena with a generator exhaust, which is all part of that. Anyway... So, yes, sometimes the people 45 metres up in the air, well, at the extreme, could be sort of 5 degrees warmer than the people on the ground because of the temperature inversion. It was strange.
Were there any major frustrations in all this? Was there always something nagging at you that you couldn't achieve?
I think we were... Certainly in 77, 78, and even in 81, we were always aware that very often we were sort of making do, that we didn't have the exact spare that we required. So someone would go away for 2 or 3 days and design a circuit, you know, to overcome the limitations of what we had. Halley ran on Dunnage 45-gallon drums. If Halley had a shield, everybody said, you know, it would be a shield with crossed shovels on it, because there were just huge amounts of mandrolics, you know, went into running the place. So it was a real sense of, you know, surely you can do this better. At the same time, there was a great pride in sort of getting through and getting the job done. Now there is much more emphasis on buying the right machine for the job. I think the thing that really hit me at the end of 1978, in 1977, we'd established a remote, very low frequency recording station up on the plateau about 100 miles from Halley. That had been my first ever field trip, and it was done at the end of April when the sun was going down. We had very few hours each day. We got stuck in a major blow. It was a real battle just to get there, to find that the wind generator that was supplying the electricity for it had fractured the blades. There's nothing more we could do, so it was just take that down, put it on the sledge, turn around and go back. And it was quite an epic trip. It was exciting. It was my first time in the field. To be honest, I was very much a passenger. I was a complete greenhorn, as the Americans would say. It took us 10 days. We got back and we thought, well, you know, we did it. And it's certainly something that's always stuck in my mind. At the end of 1978, you know, a Bass Twin Otter flew in. And one day we got up, had breakfast, got on the Twin Otter, flew up to the station, did the same job, and we're back for lunch. And... you know, the first trip in 77 was close to heroic. I don't want to exaggerate too much.
With a small H,
definitely. You know, but it was a hard fight. And you thought, well, actually, you know, it was that. And it was, I was glad I did it. But if you actually just want to get the job done, you know, then, you know, the Twin Otter was the business, you know, taking a lot of the thrutch out of it, but.
But 35 years later, would the Twin Otter team talk about it in the way that you talk about your trip? I mean, the camaraderie that you can generate on a 10-day blow or whatever.
Yeah. I think people do. I think it is still a completely fresh experience. And I think no matter how much equipment and comfort you have on base, there is still, overwhelmingly, there's still the great sense of isolation and the great sense of the fact that it's going to depend on you to do it. So I think it is discovered anew each year. I sincerely hope that's the case. I think the people I speak to when they come back, you know, they do still have that sense of discovery. It's different. But even today, you know, the last time I was down at Halley, that was 2007. We were doing relief. We came over, you know, over the radio comes the call saying, right, we've got a sledge full of stuff coming up from the ship that must not be frozen, but it was on an open sledge, i.e. you've got to get it unloaded very quickly. We go out to start unloading it. The crane on the platform won't start, fails, trips out, and the wind picks up to 35 knots at almost the same time, and it's right, we've got to get this stuff in. So form a chain of people, chain gang it in, the way we always did it previously. So, you know, the technology can always let you down. You've still got to react quickly and work out other ways of doing it.
And would the head of physical sciences division be part of that chain?
Yes, I was. Actually, I was the head of physical sciences division when I was in 2007, was part of that chain. Yes. I mean, it's because when you're down there, you know, we're all issued with the same clothing. We all look alike. I try and behave alike as well, just because I was then something different from what I'd been before. It's, you don't excuse yourselves from those sort of things.
Just picking up on that, the difference, though, in the team element of working in the Antarctic, do you think it has changed dramatically since the 70s?
Yes, I think it has. It would vary from base to base. I mean, I think the smaller bases, such as Bird Island, I don't have experience of that, but I suspect people might say perhaps hasn't changed so much. At Halley, there is much less base work, you know, just where everybody had to turn to, often with shovels or whatever. There is less base work. The plant and, well, just the way we're organised, you know, we have fuel in bulk fuel tanks. We're not constantly lifting drums out of the snow, which... So it's reduced the number of times you have to work as a team, sometimes quite large teams, you know, six or seven. That has reduced. And I'm less familiar, say, with Rothera and the peninsula, but at Rothera, the base is just so large. I mean, you know, you can, even in summer, you can be there for, you know, 5-6 days and then suddenly bump into someone who you haven't seen up to that point, because we can have over 100 people there in the summer. So, yes, it's not... it is a different experience now in that sense.
Just talking a bit more about the science, the ionospheric science. Mm-hmm. Working there in the field, were you fully aware of how valuable or not valuable that science you were producing was going to be in the future, or the practical application of it?
I think there was... I think there was a keen sense of how much was still not understood, or, well, I shouldn't exaggerate, that developed as I got to know the subject more and more. But,
well, the more you knew, the less you knew.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's the classic science phrase, isn't it? But also, just speaking to, you know, the leaders of that section before I went down to the Antarctic, you know, they would tune you into, you'd point to things on the photographic records and say, well, what's that? And they'd say, well, quite frankly, we don't know, you know. So there was a sense of unlocking the mysteries of nature, that there were still significant things to be understood. It's a little bit, it's a little bit like magnetism, you know, in that mankind has used magnetism for thousands of years. You know, the ancient Greeks knew it, observed it, and of course, very soon we were using it for navigation, but that didn't mean that anybody understood magnetism one jot, and it took, you know, 20th century physics before you start to even get a significant understanding of what's
behind
it. So
was it a sense of doing the research for the research's sake? Or was there a... I mean, I'm thinking... I suppose what I'm trying to say is in the modern day, perhaps, as I understand it, if you're going to do research, you have to have a practical application which earns the income to pay for the research.
That's a little bit of an exaggeration. We still do fundamental basic science. However, what you're talking about is the impact agenda, which is very big with all governments, not just the present government. I think when I joined, there was very much, it was basic science. Yes, we would pay lip service to the fact that mankind used the ionosphere for communication, and therefore you needed to understand it. But even by the mid-70s, we'd probably got good enough empirical models for most HF communications. What has gone way, way up the agenda and is actually in this country, in the UK, is now really very high profile, is something we call space weather. Mankind has got a huge amount of technology flying in the magnetosphere and the ionosphere, the basic elements I was studying at Halley. And space weather is the impact of solar flares, solar eruptions on the Earth's magnetosphere, the ionosphere at the foot of it, and the technology that is the satellites. Sorry, I'm saying technology. I mean the satellites that are flying in there. We have lost satellites because of solar flares, solar eruptions. Ground-based systems, long electrical power lines, get huge currents induced in them during solar storms. That has burnt out transformers. The likes of Canada has had sort of 24-hour, 48-hour blackouts in places like Montreal from space weather phenomena. So this is sort of... space weather's always been there. It's rather that, as with many other areas of modern life, man's technology has grown and grown. And now suddenly the UK is very, very vulnerable to space weather. You know, it's... we all use sat-nav, GPS navigation. Now, most of us could drive around the motorways without sat-navs, but industry uses GPS, you know, for controlling machinery. For, you know, farmers have tractors with GPSs in them that increase the yield on their fields because the way they can plough them, reap them, etc. Just all the convenience of modern life. The Americans lost a satellite, possibly because of a space weather event. It's always difficult to get 100% correlation, but it looked likely. And suddenly all the ATMs in California packed up because those ATMs were communicating via satellite communications with the banks. So we've built in a huge amount of dependency.
The more sophisticated we become, the more vulnerable we are.
Yeah. I mean, this in some ways sort of does relate to life in Antarctica. I talked earlier on about, you know, there was always a sense in the 70s of us making do, of constantly having to reinvent things because we didn't have the right equipment. Of course, we had systems that didn't have a level of complexity that prevented you doing that. I think I have a serious concern these days that we have a level of complexity that does readily prevent... I don't mean on the Antarctic basis, sorry, I mean in everyday life, that prevents you readily just quickly reinventing a solution to an everyday problem. So yes, it's the level of our own complexity, which is, you know, I'm not deriding it. It gives us great efficiency very often. I found this hotel here today remarkably easy because I had the sat-nav in the car.
What's interesting for me... this is slightly off piste, but
yeah, go on.
Don't mind for a moment. What's interesting for me is this sense that Bass is discovering the science before we as mankind need to use it. In the same way that Bass discovered the hole in the ozone layer, before we really needed to do anything about it. And Bass was working on understanding ionospherics and solar space weather before we invented the ATM or the GPS.
But it's... I think it's ever been so. I mean, if you look at lasers are in nearly every household in the country now. They're in your CD player, DVD drives, whatever, barcode readers at supermarkets. the principles of the laser, I think I'm right in saying, came out of quantum mechanics in the 1930s. Someone said, hey, you could build lasers. The technology to do that didn't exist until late 50s. And even then, when someone built one, it was still, we got this incredibly intense beam of light. What do we do with it? Nowadays, you know, in Japan, I don't know how many 100,000 lasers they manufacture every day. But, you know, so it's often the way with science. Science leads because you are uncovering new knowledge. And then people think, what do we do with it? And yes, sorry, to your point about space weather, exactly right. The thing that has really bumped it up the agenda, for example, is the realization that there was, if you like, the mother of all solar flares in, I think, 1859, and Lord Carrington, famous scientist, documented it. And it's because we did have magnetometers working then, we can see that it was an incredible eruption. And there is often the scenario that is facing many governments now is what would happen if we ever had a solar flare of that magnitude again? What would be the impact on our country and on global systems? So we were doing the science ahead of where the technology has taken us, and now we're vulnerable.
You mentioned at the very beginning of this conversation that your design not to work in defence industries. Mm. Okay, and I'm just wondering whether it's concerned you or worried you that the research that's being done into solar or space weather and ionospherics actually could have a defensive or even offensive use?
Well, it does. We know that, a lot of space weather research, which really kicked off in the early 90s, was driven by the US military. Because, A, they realised the vulnerability to their systems. And then B, if you you could explode a nuclear device in near-Earth space, that would populate the radiation belts of incredibly energetic particles that could damage, well, anybody's satellites. So, yeah, it's a little bit in the realms of science fiction, it's not science fiction. It's quite possible you could do that. So military around the world, yes, have funded space weather research. But everything we do is just, we don't have any military money in our funding. And secondly, everything we do is just published in the open literature.
Yes, but so then somebody
from
a despot dictatorship could use it. Have you ever had a moral dilemma of that nature in the work you've done?
I don't think I have, no. No, I've not perceived that. It's the closest I think we're getting to it is there is an issue. There is such a thing now as bioprospecting. It's going on around the planet. It's trying to discover novel organisms, microbes, protein strings in nature and then using it for commercial purposes. And that is getting close to the exploitation of Antarctica, if that was to happen. So I think that has been discussed. I don't think there's a serious dilemma there. I think people are saying it's a bit like the discovery of penicillin. You know, if you discovered something like that in Antarctica, why wouldn't you use it for the benefit of mankind?
Well, there's a treaty to prevent you, isn't there?
Not in my understanding, I'm not an expert on this. I mean, you should ask the Environment Office at best on this. My understanding is that there isn't. There's a treaty to prevent the exploitation of mineral resources. And that's the Madrid Protocol that was signed in the mid-90s. But I don't believe there is for bioprospecting, although I know it has been discussed at the ATCM. There is concern. But I think the concern is more about making sure that a big multinational company doesn't patent it and own it. It's more that it is made available to the benefit of mankind.
So you sense there might be, apart from the warning we were given about the hole in the ozone layer, you sense there might be something that will come out of the Antarctic in the future that would be hugely beneficial to mankind?
Oh, I think there's many, many things already. I mean, I think the ice cores are one of the most exciting things because the ice core record and the European nations, with BASS involvement, have been leaders in this. The ice cores have given us incredible insight to how our planet works, showing going in and out of the ice ages. Okay, the marine sediment record did that first of all, but the ice cores have really nailed the link between carbon dioxide and temperature of the planet over what they go back 740,000 years, nearly 800,000 years now. So that has served mankind incredibly well. It's told us our planet has this natural rhythm. It's told us about the natural boundaries in which carbon dioxide used to be before mankind started burning fossil fuels. It's still a major challenge to understand how the planet goes through those ice age cycles. We don't understand that. It's one of the biggest goals in environmental science, is to understand how you go in and out of an ice age. We know all the basics. There's an enormous amount of detail, and particularly the amplification of the original driver, which is the Earth's orbit around the sun. The amplification of that effect is not understood.
This is not the kind of conversation I'd expect to have with somebody who trained as an engineer with a GEC.
Yes.
Are you at all surprised at how your life has unfolded?
Absolutely astonished, in short. And it's I count my blessings daily, even when times do get hard. Been incredibly lucky. And it's interesting, when I go back to some of the people I was a student with, and both hear from them what they're doing, and also they themselves tell me, you know, that I've got a much greater breadth and depth of involvement in my work than they feel that they have, even though they're really quite successful in their field. Yes, there's been the opportunity to get involved in so many things. And now the position I'm in now, which is about enabling all the science across BASS to happen, you know, I've just recently got, you know, been on a marine biology cruise to understand properly how that's done. The justification there is, if I'm managing that area, I need to experience it and understand it. It's incredible opportunities. Yeah.
I'm not wrapping this up. I'm just going change gear, bring you back down to earth.
Yes.
First, I need to put a fresh disc in.
Okay, fine. Go ahead. Yes.
Momentary break.
Yep. Fine.